Hi, I'm David Edmonds of the BBC World Service, and this is The Big Idea. I found the most fascinating ideas around and the people who thought them up, and I'm going to do my best to explain them. Today's big idea, how the brain processes language. Like this word, cup. Cuppa. Cup.
I'm Cathy Price, director of the Wellcome Centre for Human Neuroimaging in London.
What could be simpler to say? Just one syllable, cup. Not only can I say it, I can read it, I can write it, I even know what it means.
Well, the first thing you have to do is to recognise the visual shapes. And the visual shape there is going to remind you of a lot of other things to start with. And you might think, is it a cup? Is it a mug? Is it a teapot? Is it a jug? So you're starting to select some representation of that cup in your head. And then you have to link that representation to the sounds of how you would communicate it to me. And then you have to move your mouth and your voice box and control your breathing to generate a sound that I then recognise as cup, while you're talking about the utensil you're using to drink there.
Linguistics, the study of language, tends to divide languages into three components.
There's the sounds of the word, so the sound cup, cup, and then there's the meaning of it, so cup is a utensil for drinking.
So there's the sound, then there's the meaning, sometimes called the semantics.
And then you'll have the grammar associated with how you construct the combination of words to describe the meaning. So in basic terms, there's the phonology, the sound, there's the semantics, the meaning, and then there's the syntax, which is the grammatical rules with which you combine words together to describe what the object is.
I'm drinking from this cup is syntax, that's the grammar.
Yes, exactly.
Technology, in particular MRI scanners, have transformed our understanding of how language works. We now know that multiple brain regions are employed for each of the three main elements of language.
With brain scanning in healthy participants, you can start to deconstruct the function of different brain regions by getting the same person to participate in multiple different tasks. So, for example, say you had a picture and you said, now describe the picture that you're looking at. Or you might say, name the objects in the picture, in which case they've got to produce the names, but they haven't got to construct it into a sentence. Or you might also then say, well, listen to this sentence and produce it back.
By separating out all the parts to language, neuroscientists can identify what bits of the brain are doing what bit of work.
This part here is responding when they're actually generating sequences of words during repetition and when they're producing a sentence. This part over here is activated whenever we just ask them to produce an event, so drinking. This part here is whenever you have a picture. This part here is listening to speech.
So that's one way neuroscientists find out about language, through brain scans of healthy patients. But there's another way, from patients who've had strokes. Stroke victims may lose the use of a part of the brain, and so may simultaneously lose one or more language functions. Some years ago, I went to watch Kathy with one of her subjects, Julia. Julia had had a stroke, and as a result, there was a lesion in her temporal parietal cortex. Kathy asked her to repeat words. Julia clearly understood these words, but listen to what happened when she tried to say them back.
Crucifix.
Say again?
Crucifix.
Cross, cross, cross.
Face.
Face.
Corkscrew.
Drink.
Good. Good. Corkscrew.
Frog.
So, for example, when she heard the word crucifix and she was asked to repeat back the word crucifix, she put her hands into the sign of a cross and then said cross. So she didn't actually say what she'd heard, which was crucifix. She said something else which had a similar meaning. She understands the meaning, but her brain hasn't linked the sound of what she's heard with the speech that she needs to produce.
So stroke patients can tell neuroscientists a lot about the brain. The complication is that not everyone uses the brain in exactly the same way. As a result, the loss of the same part of the brain will affect different patients differently.
And I guess that's the same if you look at how people walk. There are basic things where people put their legs backwards and forwards and they move their arms in the same way and they balance their heads in the same way to keep themselves upright. But there are also differences in style with how people walk and move themselves. And likewise with language, there are these differences in how they use their brains, and that might make them more or less susceptible to brain damage.
You'll know, of course, that women are better at language than men, right? Actually, that appears to be a myth. There's no robust evidence for it. What about ageing? As we get older, do we lose vocabulary? Quite the contrary, says Kathy Price. Elderly people have bigger vocabularies. But that may cause problems with word selection. It's as though the older person has a larger book collection than a younger one, and so takes longer to find the right book on the shelf.
Copy, beitsu, cop, coop, tasse, flintzani, tatsa, kapu, hob.
Multiple ways of saying the same word, cup. Many BBC World Service listeners can speak more than one language. A bilingual speaker obviously needs double the vocabulary of someone who only speaks one language. What's more, if you speak both German and English, say, and want to use the word cup, you must ensure that you don't say Tasse. Our brains manage this with a sort of lever system, which allows us to switch off what we don't need. So does that mean there's a part of the brain that is specifically designed to switch between languages?
It's not specific to language. It's also involved in selecting movements, and it's also involved within one language. But with bilinguals, they are suppressing a lot more. So, for example, we and many others have found that the head of the left caudate is particularly active when it's suppressing irrelevant words in bilinguals and in monolinguals, but more so in bilinguals. In addition, there's a part of the brain in the parietal cortex which is structurally different in bilinguals relative to monolinguals. And we've also seen exactly the same region show more structure in people who've got higher vocabularies than lower vocabularies. So those are two different ways that the bilingual brain is changing. It's acquiring more vocabulary, and that's reflected in the brain structure. And it's also having to suppress more irrelevant words, and that's also reflected in the brain activity and perhaps also in the structure as well.
Here's a weird advantage to being bilingual. Suppose you're driving along and the traffic light switches from green to amber. Because bilinguals are adept at suppressing information, at switching between words, they may be just a tiny bit quicker at processing a change in traffic lights.
So there are experimental tasks where people have shown that bilinguals are better, even though there's no linguistic processing involved at all. And one example would be for the type of processing you're doing when you come up to a green light and then it goes amber and you've got to prepare yourself to stop. And that sort of inhibition can be faster in bilinguals than monolinguals.
Before you decide you're only ever going to get into cars with a bilingual driver, you should know that the difference is absolutely minuscule. Learning a new language is a good way to keep the brain active. But the main advantage of speaking languages is the rather prosaic one. It allows you to communicate with more people in more places. Thanks, vielen Dank et merci for listening to The Big Idea from the BBC World Service. I'm David Edmonds. The producer, usually to be found in his cups, is Ben Cooper. If you've enjoyed this programme, do feel free to comment or leave a rating if your podcast provider allows this. You can even let me know on social media about the big ideas you think I should be looking at. In the next episode, why are some countries rich and others poor?